This is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Parent. Coming up on today's program, fresh clashes in Indonesia's Papua region, concerns over the latest elections in Vanuatu, Michael Woodford, the former CEO of Olympus, speaks out on fraud and scandal at the company. We have this and much more, so stay tuned. This is Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. Transparency International Vanuatu has raised concerns about the conduct of candidates contesting next week's national election. It's less than a week now until people in Vanuatu go to the polls. So far, there's been controversy over the changing of the Electoral Commission, the omission of a number of names from the list of authorized candidates, including the previous Prime Minister, apparently due to debts owed to the government, how those debts were then cleared, and also the lack of independent election observers. The president of Transparency Vanuatu International, Marie-Nicole Farreau-Patterson, speaks next with Campbell Clooney.
It has been a bit of a hectic time already with different aspects. The first one for the some personnel of the electoral office to be changed, I think within the last 2 weeks, without really giving clear explanation where they were being moved. But at the same time, hearing of some candidates not being on the list because they had debts that had not been paid to the government. Also the payment, the sudden payment, they had 72 hours to pay, and I think one member of parliament had to pay 30 million for his name to be accepted, and suddenly within 72 hours, apparently he had paid this money. The prime minister had to find 6 million. Within 72 hours, he found these 6 million. So basically, considering that there are numerous allegations during the term and during the last year or 2 years of a lot of corruption, we certainly are very interested in the leaders themselves owe it to the public to explain where the money has come from. How can you know, people are on a salary, they have received their allowances due at the end of their 4 years term, and I think they owe it to their people to explain where they can find those type of monies and who lend it to them and for what. And furthermore, during this process of the election, there is even a bigger concern because we have been informed that there are 192,000 people registered to vote, and we cannot reconcile that figure with the population.
How many more than that are on that list than there are actually of the population? What is the difference in the figure?
The difference, what it is that we have about 240,000, it's not difficult, 240,000 inhabitants. We have one of the youngest population in the world, which means that we have probably at least 50% are less than 18. So it's not difficult. You, like me, can calculate 240 divided by 2, 120. How can we end up with 190,000 people registered?
So, of course, you mentioned a couple of high-profile, the Prime Minister and another person there with 30 million vatu. How many others were able to find that money to be able to be put on that second list of candidates?
Actually, we are trying to locate that list because I think that list will need to be answered and people will need to explain how they got that money, because unfortunately this list was not publicized.
All right, so no one has been actually made aware that of whose name missed out first time but is on it a second time at this stage.
We will compare. By comparing the old list and the new list, we will be able to find out and question the people.
There's also reports that there will be no international election observers watching when voting goes ahead next week. Are you worried about that?
We are worried about that, but we received some news that some, I think there are 8 members of the American embassy that will be doing some kind of observer, and they have contacted Transparency Vanuatu. They haven't been able to assist us financially, but we certainly will try to help them as much as possible in that election observe election as much as we can, at least in the main island. I understand that they are going to send 2 of their people in Tana and 2 of their people in Santo. So there will be at least a minimum of observation. I don't know whether their report will be made public, but at least it should be accessible to the electoral office.
There's been renewed unrest in Indonesia's troubled Papua region. Hundreds of police and student demonstrators clashed in the town of Manawakari. Reports from the town say 8 people were injured in protests, including 4 police. A number of people are said to have received gunshot wounds. Pro-independence demonstrations were at the stage in a number of the city centers. It was also the first major unrest since Indonesian police shot dead a leading pro-independence figure, Mako Tamburi, in June, sparking a wave of violent protests. Liam Crockman of Radio Australia speaks next to Human Rights Watch Indonesia's Andreas Harasano.
The student organization called KNBB, the West Papua National Committee, they would like to stage a series of protests in a series of cities all over Papua yesterday. The demand is to allow an international parliamentarian for West Papua. This is a solidarity group based in London, to visit Papua. And just like what you said, this is the first street rally that is organized by the organization since the shooting of their leader in June.
Tell us more about this parliamentary group. Who was involved? Who did they want to come to Papua?
There are dozens of parliamentarians who would like to go to West Papua. You might know that since 1963, when Indonesia took over West Papua, visit to Papua is restricted. You have to get the approval, a special visa, to go to Papua when visiting Indonesia. So this is what they want to lift, that restrictions against foreigners should be lifted, because it is almost 50 years and Papua is still isolated.
And that, of course, applies to the media as well, which makes reporting on the issue somewhat difficult. What can you tell us about the latest on the casualty toll?
I heard that there were 2 protesters were shot, injured in Manokwari, and 2 others were shot elsewhere because the protest took place, I think, in 6 different cities yesterday. And a journalist was beaten in Manokwari. His name is Octavianus Pogal. He is a stringer for the Jakarta Group in Jakarta. He was taking photo of the police violence when some police officers grabbed him, choked him, beat him on his face, bleeding. His lip is swollen now. But later yesterday, I heard that the Manokwari police chief called him and apologized, and the police chief would like to meet him today to identify the perpetrators. Ogao remember one of the 5 police officers who attacked him, and he basically believed that this is an act of violence, of course, and an act against Indonesian press freedom law, and also an act of racism, because it is quite common for Indonesian police officers, they are Indonesian, they are not Papuan, they like to beat people who are, you know, dark hair, dark skin, curly hair. And it happened yesterday, despite him showing his press credentials.
The footage that was shown on Indonesian television, supposedly of the clash in Manokwari, it showed police officers, just vandalising motorbikes, smashing things, really sort of running amok, as well as, you know, firing down the street. It seemed like there was an intent to destroy property as well. And there were quite a few men who were not wearing police uniforms. They had backpacks and handguns. Do you know who they were?
They are mostly intelligence officers, whether working for the police or working for the military, working for the special forces, or working for the National Intelligence Party. They are open involved, and they are open involved in violence against Papuan.
What have the police said about the incident, aside from the specific attack on the reporter? What else have the police said since the clashes?
The deputy police chief in Papua said that he did not expect the violent police behavior in Papua, but this is, again, nothing new in Papua. Human Rights Watch has documented dozens, hundreds of cases over the last 3 years about police violence. He apologized and he promised to investigate, but again, people are usually doubtful the police will properly investigate and punish the abusive officer.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio. When Michael Woodford was made head of the camera maker Olympus, he became the first Westerner to reach the top of the ranks in a major Japanese corporation. Yet within months, he would be ousted from his post after uncovering a $1.7 billion accounting fraud that would soon rock Japan's corporate world at its core. He fled Japan in fear of his life, but not before taking his story to the media, making him the first CEO of a global multinational to blow the whistle on his own company. Michael Woodford has now written a book. It's called Exposed, Inside the Olympus Scandal. He speaks next to Cheryl Bagwell.
Olympus bought three companies, a face cream, mail order face cream company, a company which made plastic plates for microwaves, and a recycling company. And these companies had no turnover, yet Olympus paid $1 billion for them. It also paid $700 million in fees for an acquisition which had been made 2 years earlier. Inexplicable. $1.7 billion in total.
So these acquisitions were made to uncover what big trading losses at the company.
What had happened, we now know, was the company had lost large amounts of money going back two decades on securities tradings, high-risk securities trading. And in Japan, it's called a tabashi. They wanted to get this off the books. And the way they did this was off-balance sheet companies they controlled bought those securities at book value. But then they had to, you know, find the money, and that was why they went through these fraudulent transactions to hide.
So how did you stumble across these frauds?
Well, I'd been the president for just on 3 months at the end of July last year, and a small magazine called Factor in Japan, I'd never heard of it, published the allegations. But what was frightening was the mainline media in Japan didn't pick up on it. They were totally and utterly silent. And what was evident and what I learned is the Japanese media is self-censoring. They wouldn't have a go at a Nikkei-listed iconic company like Olympus.
Well, no one within the company either, besides yourself, seemed to pick up on it either. I mean, you spent, what, 30 years at Olympus before being elevated to being the president and then the CEO. Yet, as you say, within weeks in the top job, you uncovered these illegal activities. I mean, why did no one else in the company raise the red flag before you, do you think?
But they did. Somebody went to Factor. There was a whistleblower within the company, and he went to Factor. Factor published. They published twice, in actual fact. But mainline Japan didn't want to listen, didn't want to hear, and the institutions which control Japan, they didn't want this story coming out.
So there is something particularly Japanese about this scandal. I mean, obviously, it's not the first time that a major company has, you know, tried to disguise massive losses, keep it out of the public domain. I mean, you think of Enron and the big Wall Street banks before the GFC. I mean, does it say something, though, about how Japanese business operates and the media?
Yeah, I mean, fraud takes place across the world. But once it comes out in the West, then it's out. In Japan, they try to deny it. It's like Alice in Wonderland. It's very, very bizarre. Very disturbing.
And when you uncovered this and took it to the board, what happened? They sacked you.
I wrote six letters to the board. Six letters. From letter number four, I copied Olympus's auditors, which are Ernst & Young. I copied the worldwide partnership, including the CEO of Ernst & Young, around the world. So, you know, I had made it transparent, but for, you know, the sixth letter, they called an emergency board meeting, at which I was dismissed for having the nerve to challenge and question.
Our guest this morning is Michael Woodford. He's the man who blew the whistle on Olympus. This is certainly not your average corporate scandal. I mean, there were stories that the Japanese mafia were involved. And, of course, you ended up fleeing the country before taking your story to the British press. Did you really fear for your life?
In fact, when they published the second time, said there were links to antisocial forces, which is a euphemism in Japan for the Yakuza. Nearly $2 billion is a lot of money. People have been killed for a lot less. What Factor had said had been substantiated in relation to the fraud, so I had no reason not to believe there was something in it. So when I came back to London, I had police protection. When I returned to Japan in the November, I had Tokyo Metropolitan Police officers around me continuously. I was scared. My wife was petrified. She nearly had a nervous breakdown because it's white-collar crime. But when you think it could be linked to people who could be violent and hurt you or your family, it's a completely different thing.
And how was the how was it followed up by the Japanese press after that? Did they then decide to really look into it, or was it still ignored?
And after my dismissal, I was dismissed on Friday the 14th at 9:15 in the morning. By 10:15, I was meeting with the Financial Times journalist Jonathan Sobel in Japan. They ran the story front page, center page, and the Lex column on the Saturday morning. Wall Street Journal, New York Times picked it up, that weekend. The Japanese media took 10 days to arrive in London. For the first few days, they sounded like the public relations firm for Olympus. And, you know, a free press, there's fault around the world. You know, human beings are human. But at least in most Western societies, we have, as we do in Australia, a free press, which will challenge powerful people. It doesn't happen in Japan. They just followed the story. It was only when the FBI started investigating that the Japanese media felt it was legitimate to actually come over and see me.
And as I said, I mean, it has been said that this scandal does expose the kind of clash of cultures between Japan and Western business practices. I mean, is that too simple, though?
It is too simple. I don't think it's a clash of cultures. Corporate Japan is like a large golf club which has become perverted and distorted, and the institutions will protect its members at any cost. A month after I'd been dismissed, the Olympus share price was down 81.5%. $7 billion had been wiped off the value, yet the institutional Japanese shareholders wouldn't criticize the incumbent board and wouldn't offer me a word of support. It's bizarre.
It's more than bizarre. It's absolutely amazing. I mean, what does it say about, I guess, you know, we hear about the close relationship between Japanese companies and the banks, because you're talking here about the banks too that invest in them. I mean, mm-hmm. It does seem to foster this culture of kind of secrecy, doesn't it?
Everything is incestuous. It makes you question the relationship with the auditing firms, the banks, and the insurance companies control most of the share registers. They have a controlling stake with suppliers. They won't break out of that circle. So people ask me, are there many other Olympuses in Japan? And I'm sure there are.
Well, some executives have been brought to book on this. Three have since faced fraud charges, I believe, including the man that promoted you, the former Olympus chairman, Tsuyoshi Kikukawa. Where are those cases now? Have they been found guilty?
The three Olympus executives have pleaded guilty, although sentences hasn't taken place. The other three people who've been indicted, who helped facilitate the fraud, have not yet come to court.
And you've also managed to extract several million dollars. I've been reading some reports suggest $15 million in compensation from Olympus on the grounds of unfair dismissal. I mean, presumably you don't need the money. Why have you decided to write this book?
Yeah, I mean, the figure was 10 million sterling, which is, $15 million in Australian money. I want this story to come out. I mean, I love Japan. I want to try and nudge it along if I can. That's very precious to me, that people understand the way Japan works. Because if Japan doesn't change, then it's got a horrible destiny ahead of it. It's lost two decades. It was such a success story. But, you know, they don't promote young people. Women are not promoted. So many things within that society need to change. Otherwise, the society will, you know, just go from bad to worse.
Would you ever consider going back there? I mean, could you get a job back in Japan again?
Yeah, I was offered the presidency of a Japanese corporation and the chairmanship recently of a British company. But at the moment, what I want to do is tell this story. I want people to understand the way Japan operates. And ideally, I'd like to see change in Japan.
And I suppose it could be soon to be a major motion picture. It does all have all the elements of a thriller, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I was a businessman and found myself right in the middle of a John Grisham novel, and I was the lead protagonist. And there's been a lot of interest, and I don't want to say anything publicly, but I'm sure it will be made into a film.
And if you'd like to get in touch with us to let us know what you think of the program, our email address is very simple. It's focus@pcjmedia.com. Chinese officials are urging the U.S. presidential candidates not to inflame tensions between the two countries. Both Barack Obama and Mitt Romney vowed to maintain a tough line with the Asian giant over trade policies. This past week's presidential debate, Mitt Romney again labeled China as a currency manipulator, while President Obama pledged to stand on his ground in trade disagreements. We have this story from Bill Bainbridge.
The candidates' final showdown was being watched keenly in Beijing. Just hours after the closing comments, officials made it clear they weren't happy with either candidate's tone.
Any political party in the US should be rational and objective in their regard towards China's development and build on China-US cooperation and mutual trust with a responsible attitude. This is also in the interest of the US.
When it came to China, both candidates focused on Washington's economic relationship with Beijing, vowing to take a tough line.
That's why on day one I will label them a currency manipulator, which allows us to apply tariffs where they're taking jobs. They're stealing our intellectual property, our patents, our designs, our technology, hacking into our computers, counterfeiting our goods.
Governor Romney shrugged off concerns his approach could trigger a trade war, saying there was already a war going on that had led to a U.S. deficit. In response, President Obama took a similar line, pushing his record enforcing global trade rules.
My attitude coming into office was that we are going to insist that China plays by the same rules as everybody else.
China's state media has labelled the comments China bashing, but analysts argue the statements won't have a marked impact on diplomatic ties.
They do understand that this is campaign politics, and they do understand that it doesn't necessarily mean that there will be a major shift in U.S. policy towards China after if a new president comes in.
The impending leadership change in China and its economic slowdown both went unmentioned, issues one of the candidates will have to address after the election.
And finally on the program, more than 10 million couples tie the knot every year in China. Most of them were born after 1980. Single children who are the products of the one-child policy. Their parents want only the best for their child. And it's not just about staging a wedding to remember. China correspondent Hui Fente reports from a wedding held at a private country club in Beijing.
Tall and thin and young and lovely, the girl from Ipanema goes walking in. When she passes, each one she passes.
The near ubiquitous use of white is common for contemporary Chinese weddings.
Like a samba that's sweet, so good and sweet, so gentle.
But this is not your average wedding in Beijing. It's being held on the lawn of a private country club. Everything from the flower selection to the lanterns are designed to convey sophistication and elegance. Because after all, the guest list includes some prominent individuals in Chinese society. The groom is a martial arts novelist.
I personally didn't spend much time preparing for the wedding because I hired an experienced wedding planning company. The entire team managed the wedding from start to finish. That's why my experience has been relatively relaxed. But I was very busy during the last week as well because I had to keep checking the little details. I had a few hundred details to decide on during the last week.
At around $70,000, the cost of this wedding is three times what an average wedding costs in Beijing. Yang Zhi had expected the total bill to be half that amount. He didn't tell his parents because what mattered the most to him was their attendance and happiness on his big day. More than 10 million Chinese couples tie the knot every year. They are hoping to impress, and there's an ever-growing number of wedding planners out there ready to cater to that wish. This means more competition for people like Che Qi Young, who's been in the multi-million dollar wedding industry for a decade.
When we started organizing weddings, a table at a five-star hotel only cost slightly more than 1,000 yuan. But now the place we're going to tomorrow charges eight times that figure, and there's a 15% service charge on top of that.
The speed at which wedding prices have soared has left many shaking their heads, even as they accept the inevitable trend. And it's the parents of today's newlyweds who are most in shock. For them, their big day would have been in the 70s, when life was much more simple. Now, a church wedding like this one that Lu Jia and Zhou Yifen have chosen is as simple as they come in today's Beijing. Couple after couple take their turn to enter this centuries-old cathedral, with six weddings scheduled within a two-hour period every Sunday. The entire ceremony is over in just 20 minutes. Society's expectations are weighing heavily on the shoulders of China's young, especially its men who are often expected to pay for the wedding and the next big investment, the house. With real estate prices all over the country still out of reach for the average salary earner, entire families pitch in to help young couples afford their deposit. From then on, they're on their own, and the reality of this can be stressful. For any couple, their wedding is one of the most important days of their life. While it's their choice to make the occasion as big as they like, most Chinese couples say public expectation means that choice is now out of their hands, and the costs are only likely to spiral higher in the years to come.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us, once again, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. You can listen to this program again, as well as all past editions, while going to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. So on behalf of the whole team, this is Keith Parent wishing you well, saying so long. We'll see you in 7 days' time. Bye-bye.